We're excited to bring you the very first episode of The Witness Box. The Witness Box is a true crime podcast hosted and produced by me, Joshua Diaz, along with my co-hosts, Chris McDonough of The Interview Room, a former homicide detective with over 300 death investigations and a solvability rate north of 90% when it comes to those cases. He's the gold standard in homicide investigation. Also blessed to have Dr. Gary Bricado as a co-host. Dr. Gary Bricado is a clinical and forensic psychologist, researcher, and author in the areas of violence, including serial, mass and spree killing, and sexual offenses, and severe mental illness, including personality and psychotic disorders. He is a visiting scholar at Boston College, where he collaborates with Dr. Ann W. Burgess on research into forensic topics such as homicide, rape, mutilation, and dismemberment, crimes against Native Americans, and the insanity defense. He serves on the expert panel for the Cold Case Foundation, offers forensic services, and is in full-time private clinical practice in New York City. In previous work at Columbia University Irvine Medical Center, he was the co-creator of the Columbia Mass Murder Database, the largest and most definitive study of mass murder ever conducted. In 2019, Dr. Bricado co-wrote The New Evil, Understanding the Emergence of Modern Violent Crime, alongside Dr. Michael H. Stone, to present a comprehensive system of categorizing motives for offenses ranging from self-defense to severe torture in the context of serial killing. He is the author of one other book with two more in progress and nearly 100 articles for peer-reviewed journals and book chapters on psychosis and violence. Dr. Bricado is active in the media, having appeared on or consulting for true crime documentary series for A&E, Reels, Epics, Oxygen, and Peacock, and regularly providing commentary for news outlets in print and TV media. And for the very first episode, we have a very special guest, Dr. Catherine Ramslin. Dr. Catherine Ramslin, Professor Emerita, teaches forensic psychology and behavioral criminology in the graduate program at DeSales University in Pennsylvania, where she is the director for the Center for Teaching Excellence. She holds master's degrees in clinical psychology from Duquesne University, criminal justice and creative writing from DeSales University, and forensic psychology from the esteemed John Jay College of Criminal Justice, as well as a PhD from Rutgers University. And in 2008, John Jay College of Criminal Justice honored Dr. Ramslin as one of its distinguished alumni. Dr. Ramslin has appeared as an expert in criminal psychology on more than 200 crime documentaries and magazine shows, is an executive producer of Murder House Flip, and has consulted for CSI, Bones, and The Alienist. She was the recurring expert on ID's American Occult series and News Nation's Most Brutal Serial Killer series. She has published more than 1,800 articles and blogs and 71 books, including The Mind of a Murderer, The Human Predator, The Forensic Science of CSI, The Forensic Psychology of Criminal Minds, How to Catch a Killer, Inside the Minds of Serial Killers, and many more. Dr. Ramslin consults on death investigations and offers workshops about forensic psychology, investigative issues, and serial murder to law enforcement, psychologists, coroners, hospital personnel, judges, and attorneys. And we are honored to have her as our first guest on The Witness Box. I hope you enjoy. Warning: the following content may contain elements that are not suitable for some audiences. Accordingly, viewer discretion is advised. Welcome to the very first episode of The Witness Box. And that was an interesting way we kind of came about that. I was surprised we got the name as quick as we did. I thought that was something we were really going to stumble over, especially between the three of us. And it just kind of came out very organically. And so that's the name of our brand new podcast. And our guest today is Dr. Catherine Ramslin. And thank you so much for being here and being our first guest. I mean, it's very excited to have you. I have watched you on the Interview Room, and you have a new book coming out, correct?
Yes, I do. Tomorrow, actually. The Serial Killer's Apprentice.
And
amazing read, too, by the way.
Oh, yes.
Did you get an early copy of it?
Did I get an early copy?
They blurbed it.
Absolutely. I blurbed it. It was awesome.
How'd you handle
the manuscript?
Dr. Ramblin was very kind to let me participate in her work just on the back page. And by the way, she's an amazing author with over 71 books written through her career. So we're in for a treat.
Absolutely, we are. And then co-host of The Witness Box, we have Dr. Gary Bricado. You've seen him on Dateline. You've seen him on Nancy Grace, Court TV, and I believe News Nation as well, along with many other things, including The Interview Room, one of my personal favorite shows. How are you today, Dr. Gary?
Very well. Very few things as fun as getting together with this bunch. And I'm excited for the release of Catherine's book. It's, I think, as I've said elsewhere, I think is one of those instant classics that, you know, all true crime aficionados will have on the shelf. I think it's really right up there, and it blows out of the water any prior writing on the subject of Dean Corll. For those of us who are in the professional business, forensic business, it's a very powerful book, but it's also a fascinating read for people that are interested in forensic psychology from a pop angle. Just a good read on a really interesting, horrifying case. But I think it's very educational, particularly with regard to things like, you know, how to be aware of who is a predator and what the risks are and things like that, that I think make it a very important read. So it's a book that I would recommend to experts and to people that are kind of interested in a juicy true crime book. Beautiful.
I love the title. Yeah. The title is, it kind of sucks you right in. So I can't wait to get my hands on that as well. And then, of course, other co-host, we have Chris McDonough of The Interview Room. And he is a homicide detective extraordinaire. He's worked over 300 homicides with a solvability rate in the 90 percentile. I think the average is like, I don't know, 20% over the nation. It's pretty bad. You know, a lot of homicides do not get solved. And Chris and I have talked about that at length before, why how he was so successful at solving crimes. And I think it was just good old fashioned police work, knocking on doors and staying late, chasing down every lead. And so very happy to have you, Chris, as always. How are you?
I'm doing great, Josh, and thank you so much. It's very nice what you said there, and it's the luck of the Irish, the gumshoe. Got to get out and talk to people.
The most amazing thing about Chris, as I've gotten to know him over time, is that because of personal tragedy, which he's talked about openly, in a lot of places, he has channeled that into this incredible work with families and people that have experienced the loss, particularly of children. And he's been so transformative in so many people's lives from that angle. I think that humanization. And there are so many cases in which the authorities are seen as being, you know, bad guys instead of the people you can trust and that come in and heal and understand you. And I think that, you know, he really deserves a lot of accolades for that, but it's part of the story that he never seems to get them. So he'll get them here.
you know, Chris, I was a fan of Chris's YouTube channel, The Interview Room, well before I knew him. I was watching his show, and it was just, you know, at first when I first came across it, I was amazed at kind of the demeanor but at the same time getting the point across in such a thoughtful and humane way. And I really did, and very happy to have formed a friendship and very excited to be here and with our guest, Dr. Ramsland. And so I guess the what's first on the docket, Gary, Dr. Gary, you're the one that, had the questions, you know, and I think that obviously we're going to talk about the new book and we're going to talk about, I believe BTK, and, so on and so on. So, Gary, I'll let you take it away.
Well, I think just as an overview, you know, Catherine, you can kind of take this wherever you'd like, but I think what would be useful is to kind of assume that there are some listeners who are not that familiar with who Dennis Rader is, who BTK is, just to kind of give a little bit of an overview of the type of person he is and some of his offenses. I know we just had the 50th anniversary of the Otero murders, which was a mass murder. Very interesting. You know, those in the audience who are familiar with my own work know that I was one of the creators of the Columbia Mass Murder Database. That's the largest database ever done, I'm proud to say, of mass murder. And we found that about 11.78% of serial killers start out as mass murderers or commit a mass murder during their sequence of kills, you know, of killing. And BTK is one of those people who starts out as a mass murderer. You know, if those were his first offenses. And so I think he's very interesting from that and a few other angles. We could talk about that. And then we'll talk about how this task force has been created to consider the possibility that he has been linked to other offenses that are currently cold cases. Cold cases are, of course, a topic very dear to Chris and to me and to Catherine. We are all on the Cold Case Foundation, which provides resources for families and law enforcement all over the world to help solve cold cases. Right, Chris? I mean, that's very important to talk about them. And then I think we can talk generally about serial sexual homicide and the kind of offenses that Dennis Rader committed. And that will link us to Dean Corll, the subject of the book that Catherine has just come out with. And I think the most interesting thing about this conversation is going to be that Catherine has this personal connection with Dennis Rader, speaks to him routinely, corresponded with him at length, and of course wrote what I think is arguably the definitive book on the BTK case. So we can discuss that. So I think let's kind of give the floor to you, Catherine, and you can kind of, you know, fill the audience in a little bit about who this mysterious Dennis Rader is that eluded authorities for so long.
All right. Well, Dennis Rader is an American serial killer who murdered people between 1974 and 1991 in Wichita, Kansas. And did not intend to be a mass murderer. By the way, that was more just an accident that he had targeted a mother and daughter, had followed them, knew where they lived, had thought he was leaving nothing to chance by stalking them. But he did not know that on the day he chose to enter their home, the father was also home because he had had a car accident and he was recovering. And their 9-year-old son was also home, and they had 3 other kids who were in school, and they had a guard dog. So these are all things he completely missed in his attempt to be very careful. And so on the day, January 15th, 1974, his wife went to work. He dressed up in his Air Force parka because he was going to have a ruse, a ruse that he was a fugitive on the run because he had formed this plan that if you make people think they'll survive, they'll more likely comply and at least somewhat relax. He entered the house mostly because he was going to leave, but the little boy, Joey, opened the door to let the dog out. And so Rader then entered the house, found himself with 4 people, and still had to go ahead with it because now these were witnesses. He had brought a hit kit because the big thing for him was to bind people and then choke them to death. So he did that for the Otero family on that day. And this was the first murder that he committed, and he was sure he was going to be caught. And he was very really scared because it was in the middle of the day. There was, he left before the mailman arrived, but he left something there, so he had to go back. He also had modeled himself on the In Cold Blood, the clutter murders that Truman Capote wrote about in Cold Blood. So he took a radio like they had done.
Ah.
And that was something that I think had inspired him for quite a while in his life. When he was a teenager, he heard that incident over the radio, and he was with a girl that he had a crush on, and he wanted to kill her right away.
That was also intense.
By the binding, the two killers in that case had bound the family with ropes, and that was the big thing for him, was binding. So that was his first incident.
That was also in Kansas, wasn't it?
That was in Kansas, yes. It was about 200 miles to the west of Wichita.
And am I mistaken that, with the exception of the teenage daughter in the Otero case, that the victims were sort of killed in front of one another, but he isolates the daughter to the basement?
He isolated the boy to his room.
Oh, he did?
Yes, that he did. And basically killed him first. The parents were in the same room. The father was on the floor. Joseph Otero Sr. is on the floor. And the mother was on the bed. And the little girl he had strangled, but she revived. And so she was the only one left. He thought he had killed her, but he hadn't. And then he took her to the basement to hang her from a drain pipe.
It's very interesting because, first of all, I believe he left fluid at the scene of that crime, right? I mean, certainly it would be a very different story nowadays in terms of what we would have been able to do with that evidence. And the other thing is interesting listening to you tell this story, because I have heard people say there was this idea that he was particularly interested in the children, that they were really the folk. But the way you're telling it makes me think that it was really the daughter and the mother.
It was the daughter and the mother. He was not interested in Joey. Joey just was collateral damage in his mind. His fantasy had been that he would kill. He thought it would just be the mother and the two kids. And he was going to kill the little boy and then take the mother and daughter to an abandoned barn, because that was his big fantasy. So it was a fixation on the two of them together, and it didn't turn out the way his fantasy was, because first of all, their car didn't have any gas in it, because he was going to drive their car away. It didn't work. Nothing worked the way he was expecting it to. And so he thought he was going to get caught.
You know, it's a something that one day somebody like us, you know, has to write about, is this fascinating topic of what happens when a control obsessed person who is playing out a fantasy discovers that the fantasy doesn't go the way you expect it to. Is that exciting? Is it scary? Does it make them think they have to do it over again to get it better next time? Do they adjust the fantasy? Do they escalate by accident and find that it's actually very arousing? It's an interesting topic, to be honest.
Yeah, and he actually ended up using an exercise ball to strengthen his hands, because he didn't realize how hard it was to strangle somebody, how long it took, and his hands got tired. He also tried out different types of gloves. And that particular incident, he had those dishwasher rubber gloves that were very clumsy. And so he then looked for other types of gloves that would give him a better feel. Yeah, he was scared, but he was also really excited that he had done this. He had pulled it off, because it had been a fantasy of his for a very long time.
That's where I was going to go. What, unpack for us what that process was like for him, the buildup.
Buildup really came from his teenage years. And even before that, when he was a kid, he used to play cowboys and Indians. And when he would get tied up, that would be very arousing to him. So he began to do autoerotic sexual activities by binding himself. Hmm. And then he began, as he became interested in girls and they really sort of threw him off, he started thinking about girl traps, is what he called it. You know, keeping them bound, keeping them captive and under his control, because when they weren't under his control, then that meant they were in control of him. And they basically made him feel inferior. And this was his way of exerting his superiority. He also fantasized about tying them to a railroad track and having trains run over them.
Like in those old silent movies or something?
Yeah, Dudley Do Right. That's exactly the inspiration. Yes.
When he became interested in girls and he was practicing the tying up on his own, and what was he? Are you saying that he was like kind of shunned by women, and is or did he have?
He was not shunned. He was just shy. Oh,
yeah,
he wasn't not a very good student, so female teachers made him feel inferior. And he, not that they intentionally did, but that's how he read it. He was the oldest of four boys. And growing up, you know, he was kind of in charge. And suddenly these females come along and he stumbles all over himself. But, you know, later in high school and college, he did have girlfriends. And he had even girls who were just friends. So it wasn't that they shunned him. It's that he developed these fantasies about really wanting to dominate and control them.
Interesting. Dr. Ramzan, have you been able to figure out what that crossover point was where, you know, he's tying himself up and it turns into this autoerotic situation where, you know, what was the trigger in the crossover into that? Do you know?
Well, you mean what moved him toward thinking about doing this to others?
Yes.
Yes, correct. It was True Detective magazines.
Oh, interesting.
The salacious covers, but in particular, the one that featured Harvey Glattman, who posed as a photographer and told women that he was, you know, going to put them on the cover of detective magazines and then bound them and killed them. And turned out they did get on the cover. And Dennis Rader saw the look on the faces of these women who were abjectly terrified. And this is the look he wanted to duplicate. He was 14 when he read that magazine. And it aroused him so much that he began to really think about wanting to duplicate what Glattman had done. And then he read a few other detective magazines like H.H. Holmes. And he created in his fantasy these role models, serial killers, who were doing the kinds of things that aroused him. So I know a lot of people don't think we should be blaming, you know, pornography and these, but so many of these serial killers from that era say those magazines, those salacious covers of scantily clad women bound and terrified, were figured large in their fantasies. So many of them say that. I don't think we can be dismissive.
Go ahead, Chris.
No, that's all right, Doc. Go ahead, Gary.
Well, I was just going to say, as an interesting side note, that there used to be comic books in that era that also had covers like that. You remember the Tales from the Crypt and, you know, the Vault of Horror and all those kinds of comic books. And it's interesting that the Comics Code Authority, which was a code that kind of tidied up the content of those comics, it came as a result of the work of Frederick Wortham,
right,
who was the psychiatrist at Bellevue who evaluated Albert Fish.
Right.
And he became convinced that that kind of literature may have been part of the cause for people like Fish who progressed into these horrible offenses, that it fueled the fantasy. And then insisted that children should not be exposed to that kind of literature. And then you wind up with the banning of a lot of that kind of comic book, but you could get away with it in a magazine. And but there was no code, you know, as far as I understand it, to protect against that. But I think that was an early instinct that kind of sexualized violence needed fuel, as Chris often calls it, that you have to fuel it. And but was there a precipitating event like losing control or some kind of life event where you felt like a failure or something that preceded the Otero? Because we, you know, Chris, we've seen in many cases, and Catherine, I know you have too, with serial killers, that you need that match to the straw that finally sets off enacting the fantasy. Was there one
there were a series that kind of led up to it, of humiliations at the hands of, you know, like his mother and these teachers, that he would store these resentments, as rigid personalities tend to do. They don't digest it. They they store it and they remember and they want some kind of payback. But in his case, right before the Oteros, he had lost a job that he really loved at Cessna. He really loved working with the mechanics and whatnot of all that. He had been in the Air Force. This had given him a really, and he had just gotten married. This had really given him a sense of status. And he lost the job. He was laid off. So at that point, he broke into a house. He also had tried to abduct a bank teller and failed. So he now knew there was a witness to him doing these things. But the Oteros were pretty directly associated with this, what he perceived as a failure on his part of losing this job. And it made him very angry. And that's when he already had the fantasies going, but that's when he decided to act out.
And he had them, that those people picked out. I mean, that was a premeditated situation. He been stalking them or
Julie and Josephine. He had seen them together. He had followed them and figured out where they lived, and even had called, had used a reverse directory, I think, of some kind in the library, and even had called to find out who was in the house. He didn't do a very good job of that, but he did try.
That seems to happen a lot in these kind of, when there's a mass casualties, you go in thinking it's going to go one way and, things go haywire constantly. And kind of like what you said as well, Dr. Gary, if these crimes were committed today, he wouldn't have been on the run. Probably. I mean, I'm speculating, for as long as he was. I mean, if you're leaving DNA evidence, in 74, I don't even, I mean, was there even DNA testing back then?
No.
And he left semen. I mean,
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
A lot of it.
And had he been in jail before? Like, was he on?
Yeah, but now, to that point, though, let me just say this. If there were that kind of testing back then, he would have known about it and done something to circumvent it. That's right. What they do all the time is read about what's going on. And he took courses at the local university in criminal justice. And in fact, in one lecture, I think it was a guest lecturer, one of the coroners talked about the autopsy on one of his victims. And there he is sitting in the class.
What's in his kill kit?
Mostly different kinds of bindings. Mm-hmm. A knife, couple. He carried one or two guns, depending on what he was going to do. Clothing, because he wanted to change clothing. So kill kit changed, as they tend to do, with different situations, and wasn't even always the same carry-all bag, because once he used a briefcase, and he was dressed up in a tweed blazer because he was in his James Bond mode. So the kill kit would always have bindings of different types. He tried out all different kinds of things.
So he had like these ruse personas, like you talked about him dressed up in the Air Force uniform and stuff. Was he an officer or an enlisted person?
He was enlisted, and it was like a parka.
Perfect. Interesting. And what was his ruse going to be?
And I think he got this up from the Zodiac killer, though he claims he didn't pay any attention to that case. I know that he did. It was, I'm a fugitive, I'm on the run. I just need your car. I just need some clothes or some food or, whatever. The ruse was, just do what I say and you'll be okay.
Yeah.
And another one was a telephone repairman. He had gone to an open house or something, and he saw everybody's business cards, and he grabbed one that had an emblem from a telephone repair company, and he got a helmet and pasted it on so that he could knock on doors and pretend to be a telephone repairman, that he needed to come in and look at their phone.
Really interesting. But remember back in the day, what was the TV show? Wasn't it The Fugitive?
Yeah,
it was. I wonder if did he ever mention that was an inspiration?
No. Okay. Right.
Interesting. So he came up with all these props all on his own.
He's not original.
Okay.
He means he read about them in true crime books or the detective magazines. For example, his second victim, he used a knife on her because he had read an article about using a knife and how to kill somebody efficiently with a knife. But he didn't like it, so he never went back to doing that. But he was an experimenter, but he did not originate ideas. And almost always he got them from reading what someone else had done.
Why didn't he like it?
It was bloody and just didn't have the same feel as strangling somebody.
And in total, that day, there was four people, correct, that lost their lives?
With the Oteros, yes.
The Oteros. And that's this year's the 50th anniversary of those murders.
Yes, it was January 15th, 1974.
Wow, yeah.
And he keeps track of that. He always really? Says the date of his arrest, which was in February, and each of the murders, he always talks about them.
Very interesting.
It's interesting that you say, you know, when you say he didn't like it, you know, I think for some people that's going to sound weird because they're going, well, wait a minute, this guy is, you know, killing these people. But to your point, Dr. Ramsland, is, you know, he has this, I don't even know if we want to call it a feeling of some sort, but I guess it, early on he did, and he kind of was able to compartmentalize that, right? Is that what you're...
Well,
what you
he, I mean... For him, it was about arousal. It's a lust murder. He wants this experience to be a sexual high. And the stabbing someone did not achieve that for him.
Interesting.
Well, you know, there's a story that's told by his daughter, who is an author and a victims' rights advocate, as we all know, Carrie Rawson. She tells a story about being at the dinner table with her father, her brother, so forth, and a dish of pasta falling on the floor in the kitchen, and her father exploding into BTK, becoming, for losing control and for a moment, strangling her brother at the table. And I remember asking her in an interview, is it possible that all the sauce reminded him of blood? Because there's this moment at which he feels out of control, that something gets too sloppy, he doesn't like it, it seems to. And I can't help but wonder that control was the center of this entire thing. I mean, he's everything about the uniforms and the particular fantasies that he had and the binding seemed to all be about having everything in your grip. And if you lose it, it may fuel you to have to go out and play out that fantasy to kind of get your life tidy again. And I just wonder what you think about that idea about control.
Yeah, he was diagnosed with OCD. So, yeah, he definitely has issues with control. I don't know about the, I don't know that it would have been reminding him of blood because. Yeah, it
could just be an idea.
I think he didn't like anything out of the natural order according to how he wanted things. I just think he didn't. So. And I would guess, and I don't know this for sure, but I would guess there's probably friction between him and his son already. I don't think he would just jump out of nowhere and strangle him. Right. So I would think there was probably some ongoing tension between them anyway. But yeah, I mean, that he would mess up the kitchen, that would be an issue. And Rader's still like that. I mean, he keeps meticulous notes. He, his cell is, or now he's in the infirmary, but his cell was, you know, piled high with stuff, but very, you know, very organized. And he hated it when he had to go through it and get rid of stuff because he knew where everything was. And
yeah. Still, does he keep, he keeps track of the news on him still to this day?
Oh, nothing is more important than his fame. Nothing.
Wow.
Yes. In fact, I'll never forget the day that Carrie first came out and gave an interview after 10 years. So 10 years had gone by and since his arrest, and she finally gave an interview to someone at the Wichita Eagle and talking about her pain and how he transformed her life. And what he said to me was, did you see I got my name in the paper?
Oh, interesting.
Are you kidding? Yeah.
Disturbing. I've seen that he autographs things like that. articles about victims, things like that. And it's interesting because with these OCD slash narcissism, you know, kind of core killers, is very interesting is the role of stalking as another expression of that, kind of complete control over people. Yes. And I think there, I haven't, and I know you will know everything about it, but I actually have not heard that much detail about his stalking process. I mean, what did he do? Did he sit outside the house?
He would, in the neighborhoods where he would go look in people's windows, there were backyards with these alleys that he could go. And so, and he broke into a lot of houses where nobody was home, and it made him feel like he was in charge of them. And he would always take some little item, even if they never noticed it, he knew that he had something over on them. And he would look in windows constantly, sometimes to potentially look for victims, sometimes just to feel superior to people.
Did it lead to masturbating or anything like that?
Yes. Yes, it did.
Yeah. So
he's a sexual sadist. Would that be the correct term for him?
He's definitely a sexual sadist. Yes.
Right. And he's a pretty prolific artist. I don't know.
I would say he's a prolific drawer.
Perhaps is the word artist. But I guess what I want to know is, do you know if as a child or teenager, that was part of the fuel for him? Was he doing a lot of drawing?
He did drawings. He did these girl traps. He would draw them on the boards when other kids went out for recess. He'd draw them on the boards in school.
Interesting.
Teachers never picked up on it.
Did anybody early on, were there any red flags like that somebody caught and said, you know what, this one could be interesting? Teachers sometimes, you know, they have that sixth sense.
Not that I know of. I and especially back then, that was, you know, 50s, 1950s. Right. I don't really think they were looking at little kids that way. Not that I know of. I don't know. In fact, his mother, I remember when he was arrested, she's like, what was it, because I dropped him on his head when he was a little kid? Or they were astonished. Mm-hmm. And all his brothers went down to the courthouse where he was being interrogated, saying, you have the wrong guy, there's no way. And he was confessing.
Well, you know, Catherine, you're raising a very important and subtle point, which is that it is very easy for people to miss that prior to the 70s, when, you know, the behavioral science unit gets together with people like John Douglas and Burgess, who we know intimately, who, you know, I work with her all the time at Boston College. She's on the Cold Case Foundation with us. Very easy to miss that until that group got together and started studying serial killers, that we didn't even know that some of these things were red flags. They hadn't been a sample yet to say, oh, you know, sitting around and fantasizing from the time you're a child may be a precursor to going out. And, you know, in fact, we'll see a lot of that in the bio series that's coming out about her on Hulu in a couple of months. And I'm allowed to say that I was on the program, and I'm really happy to see that we're going to start to get a little taste of her really important contributions to that. And, you know, did he start out as somebody who initially wanted to commit sexual assault, or he always envisioned killing as part of the thrill?
He wasn't committing sexual assaults.
Well, that's what I want to know. In other words, did he envision that the strangulation, for example, was going to be sexually arousing?
Well, the way he puts it is he did not want to betray his wife. So.
Oh, I see. I mean, obviously the masturbating after hanging.
Right. It's not the same as a sexual assault of a victim.
Right.
So it was really just the eroticism of the binding. That was the most important thing. And then the control. And he'll even probably say he had to kill them because he had done these things that are trespass, that are illegal, and they had to die because they were witnesses.
Right. Now,
so it wasn't, there's a distinction to be made between erotophonophilia, that is murder as the arousing thing, right, and they have to die now that I've done my thing to them because they know who I am.
Exactly.
There's a big difference between those two things.
Right. I was just writing about that for a forthcoming book. I did a chapter on that. And I found that the vast majority of these guys are not killing as part of the arousal.
Right.
Killing just to eliminate a witness, essentially. But there are all different reasons why they spill over into killing. But it does seem to be mostly about victim elimination, or that they assert so much force that the person dies unexpectedly during the assault. And some of them wind up liking that and some don't. Now, maybe you could talk a little bit about how he comes up with the BTK persona. I've always been confused about where the T comes from, because he doesn't seem to be in torture.
Gary, it's funny you say that, because I was wondering, what does he think of his nickname? I mean, what
he came up with it. He's one of the few killers that decided he's leaving nothing to chance. He's not going to be saddled with a stupid name. Right. He wanted a name that would generate, would trigger fear in Wichita. He wanted to control the town. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to tell you, some of his alternate names were not very scary. Like
what
the
were
Poet
they?
Strangler.
The Stoke?
That's one of them. because he wanted to get that poet thing in there because he was a poet. And he had several variations on that.
Yeah. So.
But the BTK was his idea. And it was before he actually, I mean, he had at this point, I think, killed the Oteros, but and Catherine Bright. But I think he had that name in mind for a while. And even though, and obviously anybody who's strangling somebody, is torturing them, he's not like Richard Cunningham, for example, right. who was, or Bittaker and Norris. I mean, he did right. not participate in those kinds of horrendous, drawn-out tortures of victims. So some people would say the torture part is overblown, but psychological torture is there. I think he did tell one victim, it was Nancy Fox, that he was there to kill her. He was BTK. So that would have, for however long she remained alive, would have been terrifying.
Did he say how long she stayed alive?
He has not said that, no. And some, there are times he's denied that he said that to her, but he's also said that he said that to her. So.
Interesting. And how did you connect with him? How did you become his biographer and his confidant?
Serendipity. There was a woman when he first got arrested who wanted to write a book with him. Oh. He got involved with her. They corresponded for 5 years. I knew about her because she was in newspapers at the time. So I saw her on Facebook and said, whatever happened to your book with BTK? She knew who I was because she was using one of my books. She had never written a book. She had gotten in over her head pretty much and did not want to continue this. So she asked if I would take it over, but it wasn't a simple matter of taking it over because she had arranged for him to sign his life rights over to the victims' families. So they had control over who was going to do this. But it was fine because I and some other people, you know, wanted to do it. There were some journalists and that they turned down. But I came along and said, I had this expertise. I'm an academic, I'm a researcher, and I want to interview him in such a way that it will benefit law enforcement, forensic psychology, and criminology. And the greater share of the proceeds would go to the victims' families. And I was fine with that.
Huh. Yeah, so you actually approach it from not only the position of a doctor, but from the academic position to educate,
yes,
law enforcement, guys like me that were, pushing things around at that time. And now, interesting enough, how just shifting gears for a second, he's kind of resurfaced in about August of 23. His name kind of came to the, to the public's mind again in the Shauna Garber case. But we had talked about that, and you had very firm understanding of, look, this is not his play here. This one's not going to stick. And so how did that unfold? And was he aware of it?
Well before August of 23, I already had told him about the case because I had seen a web sleuth sort of put the case out there and is, could this be a Dennis Rader victim? So I looked at the case and I talked to them about it. And within about maybe a month or two, Sheriff Eddie Burden from Oklahoma came to the prison. So he came in the end of January of 23 to talk with Rader about one of his cases, a missing person from 1976. And he latched on to the Garber case, and he talked to the Missouri investigators who had been on the Garber case for a long time. Maybe they should go talk to him themselves, which they did. So he, I think that was early summer. So this is before any of the media has gotten a hold of it. That was early summer. FBI came in on it. They gave him immunity if he would just confess and help them close the case. And Lori Howard and Rhonda Wise were the two detectives that had been on it for a long time. And they felt when they talked with him, as did I, that despite the many things that seemed to link him, and there were some, he did not talk about that case the way he talked about his own. There's a significant qualitative difference. And he couldn't even remember Shauna's name when they were talking to him, but he knew every single detail about his own victims. And he had an excitement when he talked about his own cases that was completely missing. And he thought the guy who had killed Shauna was really sloppy because he had used six different bindings on her in a way that he said he'd never do. It was overkill, it was sloppy, it was not at all what he would have ever done. And they gave him immunity if he would just confess. And he said, I'm not confessing to something I didn't do. So no. And they felt satisfied with that. Why? Because they did have another suspect that they wanted to look further into. And they just didn't feel like he was giving them really anything that would, they had no physical evidence tying him. But the reason people did think, and I myself did, when I first saw it, is the binding. It was pretty elaborate, and it was some of the kinds of things he would use, like paracord, different types of ropes, different thicknesses. But there was coaxial cable, which he would have never used. I think there was some duct tape. There was a number of different things, six different bindings. And I had not ever seen him do that on any of the victims that he had, although some were elaborate.
How old was she?
I'm sorry.
How old was she?
Shauna was 22.
22, yeah.
And they didn't, the other things were that it was a part of Missouri that wasn't far from where he was raised by his grandparents in the southeastern part of Kansas. So it was he had traveled around there, when he's on the census in 1990. So it seemed to fit that he could have, they suspected she'd been picked up. She was dumped on an abandoned farm, so farm property, which was in his fantasies. But I said, but she wouldn't have been dumped outside. She would have been inside the farmhouse or the barn, specifically the barn, because that's his fantasy, is inside. So I had reservations because even though there were these superficial links, there were enough dissimilarities for me to say, I don't see it. And especially after I talked to him about it, I bought it that he wasn't responsible. And now the case has been closed and it wasn't him.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because, you know, that's almost like the Lucas effect, right? Henry Lee Lucas, where, you know, the authorities would, you know, the Texas Rangers.
Close it for us, yeah.
Right. The Texas Rangers had this guy, and, you know, they were taking him all around the United States, and, man, he was loving it. But it's interesting what you said, because Dennis says, well, that guy was sloppy. Yes. I mean, that goes against his whole grain. Exactly. Didn't feel like he was trying to, that the other, the suspect that ultimately that they arrested, did he feel, or at least identified, did Dennis feel that this guy was kind of a copycat of him?
No, he did not think that, because he just thought it's not related to me.
Okay.
And it's very interesting to me because he says to everyone who comes, and he was just visited recently again by another cold case team, why wouldn't I confess? If I have immunity, nothing will happen to me, and I'll get more victims to add, and I'll be more famous. Why wouldn't I confess? And no one can answer that question.
Well, that distinguishes him from Zodiac, right? Who was happy to take credit for victims that had nothing to do with him. Right.
No, he said, I'm going to tattoo 10 on my body, so that when I die, no one will be able to erase that.
How did Shauna Garber actually die?
All right, so what they determined, and they already had this guy in their scopes, and I will give Lori and Rhonda a lot of credit for backing off BTK, who looked like a good suspect, and saying nope, because it just doesn't.
These are the Missouri detectives, right?
They had an idea about this guy named Tolfi Reeves. Now they also talked to Larry Hall, another serial killer, as a potential, because he was a truck driver. But they had this guy kind of in their sights because in 2004, someone had written a letter to the sheriff's department saying that Tolfi Reeves had murdered a young woman and the circumstances fit Shauna Garber. And they hadn't named her, but the circumstances were similar. And nevertheless, they didn't know who Shauna was. They went through a very elaborate identification process with facial reconstruction and finally DNA. So she's found in 1990. They don't identify her, I think, until 2021. They don't know who she is. At that point, they're able to go through a genetic, you know, the genealogical kinds of investigation. They identify a brother and a sister who have been trying to find Shauna for many years and unable to do so, who are able to give them a lot of information. And then their suspect died in a motorcycle accident in November 2021, and people came forward who had been scared of him. One was a witness and knew what he had done to Shauna and said, and this is the interesting thing for investigators everywhere, everybody put a lot of attention on those bindings. Who's the kind of person who would do this? He must be doing this to other people. It's so elaborate. Turns out, he had borrowed a black truck that was the stuff that was in the back of the truck.
Oh, wow.
Just this guy who had the truck, the stuff he had back there is what he used because he had picked her up. She was working at a chicken processing plant in the area, and she was walking on the road. It was Halloween night. She was walking on the road. They picked her up, and he molested her. And she was screaming and screaming. And to try to shut her up, he injected her with a big dose of methamphetamine and an overdose and killed her.
Wow.
So, you know, no relation to Dennis Rader. But the interesting thing for me, I think, is so many people put an emphasis on that, those bindings and the way they were done and what kind they were. Because one was a military cord that was only available to the military in 1990. So that gave them some clues. And it turned out it was a borrowed truck and it wasn't Reeves' stuff at all.
Well, this is a fascinating example of how profiling can go haywire.
Yeah.
And a really good illustration of what we were talking about earlier, that sometimes the kill is accidental. That it wasn't part of the thrill at all. And there was no torture at all. She was bound, wrangling or nothing. So it was intended essentially as a sexual assault.
Yes. But when they were in an area where her screams were echoing around this valley and it was Halloween night. And so he just, said, I don't want us to. And I guess they had parked near that abandoned farm and I don't want anybody to come. Right. And so she got killed that way.
Now, how did this?
But I will say, interestingly, Dennis Rader. So when I told him the news that it's not you, he wanted to know, what about the bindings? That was the very first thing he said, what about the bindings?
Yeah, that's fascinating.
Yeah, and I told him that it wasn't even about any kind of sexual fetish. It was just those were there in the truck.
Talk a little bit about how this task force came together and the, what it is they're trying to accomplish and how many cases are being looked at in the same way and all of that and what Dennis has to say about it, because you're speaking to him routinely. So,
well, and for a while, the FBI were in on this. They questioned him as well. They were going to have a federal grand jury, which never materialized. This all goes back to Sheriff Verdin from Oklahoma, who had taken from the Wichita police the things they had confiscated from Dennis's house and office when he was arrested, that were lots of journal. He kept many journals, drawings, really elaborate, horrible drawings of bound women and girls. And, you know, sometimes their throats cut and whatnot. So he had all of this stuff, and he thought he could match some of these drawings or journals to incidents of either missing women or women found who had not yet, the case had not been yet been solved. One of which was the Garber case. Another was the three, it's another Missouri case. There was a mother and daughter and her daughter's friend who went missing. It's the Springfield Three. That's it, the Springfield Three. Oh. That was another one he thought. And then his own case in Pawhuska of Cynthia Don Kenny, who had left a laundromat where she worked for her aunt and uncle and had disappeared. So he thought, and there was something in Rader's journal called Bad Laundry Day, an entry called Bad Laundry Day, that is very ambiguous. And it was specifically about a laundromat in Wichita where he described looking for victims because he thought it'd be easy to snatch someone out of a laundromat. And he lived on a particular street at that time and names the street in this journal entry. The bad laundry day was that it was a bad day for him because he missed, he failed. And he gave me a list of 55 projects, only 10 of which actually turned into murders. The rest were failures. So, but because it was a laundromat, Sheriff Verdin thought it referred to Pawhuska. And the bank across the street from the laundromat had been wired by ADT, which was a company Rader had worked for at the time, but there were no records saying that he had actually been in that bank doing any kind of work. But Verdin was making sense of this way. Also, there's a triangular building in that town, and Dennis had a big thing about threes. So, I mean, you're hearing me look at the way speculation forms a web around. It becomes this kind of cognitive bias we call focalism, where you get very focused on something and you arrange all the facts around it. And anything that doesn't work, you throw that out and you overemphasize certain facts to make sure they fit what you're focused on. And I think that's
like you're seeing conspiracy theories and things like that.
But then he switched it because there was also a victim in Wichita who, a woman who was murdered, who had just come from a laundromat. So now he's switching it to that. But the Wichita police had already questioned Dennis Rader on that particular crime and had dismissed him as a subject, as a suspect for it. There are several others in Kansas, one out of Topeka. There's another one in a town that had a mask store. So because Rader had masks, there's the connection there. So those are the cases he's currently working on. And he then, I think through Rader's daughter, was able to gather interest from the people who are, he names on the task force, Nancy Grace, Paul Holes, I guess Anne was on the task force for briefly. She was put on the task force, Ann Burgess, Cheryl McCollum. These are all people who have access to the ability to test the items that he comes up with. And he did go dig under a sidewalk that the city had laid on Rader's former property, because Rader had written, remember the woman who started the book with him? He had written to her, he'd written her a letter saying that he had buried some trophies under the shed on his property, and he had moved them. Then they were related to the crimes that he had already confessed to, not new crimes, but he had moved them, but he wasn't sure. And so he had told her to go look. She never did. But the letter was in the stash of things that that Sheriff Burden got from the Wichita PD. And so he thought, he went and dug up that hole and claims he found items of interest. Also on the property on in plain sight was a knotted pantyhose that he found in May of 23. I think it had to be because that's when he first talked to me. So he thought that might be a binding that Rader had used on a victim and that you could test that for DNA. But it's, but the property had been, the house had been razed. It had been turned into a access to a park. It's been many years since Rader was arrested in 2005. A knotted pantyhose. And Rader said, oh, I used pantyhose to hold up tomato plants. Mm. So the ambiguity of the evidence is right. always at play. So now if you have a task force, though, who has the ability to test it for free, basically, because they do, what are the results of these tests?
Well, what's going to be interesting here is in Homicide 101, you always go, if you have a suspect and that suspect's in custody, like Dennis Rader, and he has been for many, many years, and he has a rapport with you, and, you know, you're like the guru that knows this guy inside and out. You're a doctor, you're a psychologist. I mean, see, you get all of those sides of the coin that you check, and then you say, as an investigator, okay, well, let's see what Dr. Ramsland says. Let's go talk to her. Okay. And then, right. So, I mean, my first question is always going to be, have you ever been interviewed at length about him by this task force?
No.
Okay. So
and
then
they all know me.
Oh, I'm sure they do. Yeah. Everybody knows you. If you're
I mean,
like,
they know me enough to be able to approach me and talk with me about it.
Of so course. No. Yeah. Well, and then that leads me to the second point here is, you know, you've got this guy, he's in custody, he's in a controlled environment. You can ask him all these questions. And to your point earlier, well, why wouldn't he just kind of say, yeah, that one's mine. This one's not mine. This one's mine. Because it's interesting that law enforcement goes to, you know, these types of offenders about other offenders like them and says, hey, you know, kind of give us some insight here about why this person would be thinking this way or doing these things. And we take that as gold and say, okay, you know, Gary Ridgway gave us information about A, B, C, and D. Okay, and we're gonna run with that. It reminds me of Ronald Porter. Remember Ronald Porter from 1985 to 1990 in San Diego County?
Wasn't that one of your cases, Chris?
Well, I was there. I was part of, I went into homicide in 1990, just as he was getting wrapped up. But I had interviewed some of the prostitutes at that time. And one of them, her name was Frederica Goldstein. Her street name was Freddie. And I had two of my girls actually ended up being his victims. But fast forward, you know, the information that was being provided, you know, by the investigation as a whole was, and it was a task force. It was a very successful task force. We ended up getting him, and, you know, he ended up obviously getting convicted on a couple of the cases, but not all of them. I mean, Donna Gentile was one that he went down for, and she was like 22 years old at the time. But anyway, where I'm going with this is, where's the FBI on this one right now with this task force? Are they engaged into this, or have they said, you know what, we'll be over here. Give us a call if you get something.
Well, I know the OSBI, Oklahoma, has decided that's it. They're done. They're done with investigating him. I believe the FBI has also said that. They, again, this is all before the media got a hold of this, all during the summer of 23. There were two, one of the, and I've never said 10 is it, but I have said if he has other victims here, it's because it's a death penalty state.
Sure.
However, he has immunity now. So that's now that doesn't matter. The only other thing, and this is the one that Sheriff Burden put forward, he doesn't want to be moved from his cell in Wichita. And that, so that would mean, so he would never confess because he doesn't want to ever end up being moved. But he said to him, bring it. I'll move.
Why would they move him?
Because if they're going to prosecute him for one of the crimes,
they have to take him back to where the crime was. Gotcha.
Yeah. So then we have to ask ourselves, what's the real motivation here? Is this another Lucas effect? And this is my opinion only, my experience. Is this another Lucas effect where they're just kind of wanting, the amazing things to come forward that, we got Dennis Rader on another situation, yada, yada.
Right.
And everybody goes, look at us. We're good. Or is this a situation that Dennis Rader is looking at them and going, almost like he played the cops during when he was on the run for 30 years, where it's like close but no cigar. It's not happening, guys, but you can go down the library and open a book and you'll find a letter in there. I think he's got to be loving this side of the coin.
No, he doesn't. He does not at this point. Good. He did when it first started.
Okay.
But he's tired of it.
Good.
He really is. And it's also interesting that when they first arrested him, they thought he was good for 7, maybe 8. He then delivered the final 3 to them. So he willingly told them his cases. They also questioned him on a number of others in the Kansas area. So you have to then wonder what do the Wichita police think about all this? They've already gone over a lot of this ground themselves. And is their work being completely dismissed?
Dr. Ramslin, you mentioned the Springfield 3 earlier.
Yeah.
Is that still an unsolved
case? Yes, it is. Yeah.
Any suspects?
There was somebody who called in and said they were buried under a parking structure. So it was, the police said, well, that they didn't make much sense of it. And they were not about to tear down a parking structure on somebody just calling in without any further evidence. So there was that, but there isn't a clear suspect. There is a suspect in the Cynthia Don Kinney case, but he's dead, similar to what happened with Garber. Sheriff Burden genuinely wants to solve the Cynthia Don Kinney case. I think he really, really does. Yeah.
Yep.
But this has become, flowered into something much bigger that you have to wonder about the potential about wanting fame or wanting attention through, I'm going to solve all these other cases.
So yeah, my concern becomes, I'm sorry, Josh.
No, go ahead.
My concern becomes, the collateral damage with the arguments between the district attorney and the sheriff and that. In that area, I mean, they're suing each other. I mean, who does that? In our profession, it's like, come on, we're supposed to be arm in arm, hand in hand. And if it's there, fine. If it's not, then we have to respect each other's position. I.e., the district attorney says, look, it's not there. The sheriff says, I think it is there. And, it turned into this mishigosh that I think it's eventually going to, play itself out. If they did get something, it's going to play itself out in a very negative light.
Yeah.
And
well,
so
I mean, my question is always, I saw the pantyhose in April or May of 2023. By now, why hasn't it been tested?
Right. Yeah. I
mean, he was handling it with his bare hands when he was showing it to some people.
I saw it on the news.
Yeah. Right. So I don't get it. What? And all these items of interest were dug up in the fall of 23. Right. We can't, there should be something. Right. Now, it's possible there is something and they're just not telling anybody. That is possible. But then why wouldn't the DA know that?
You know, it's an interesting thing about that Springfield 3 case. I remember reading was that on New Year's Eve of 1992, they did an episode of America's Most Wanted about that case. And someone called in to the switchboard with information that only the killer could possibly know. And they did this whole thing where they tried to get this guy to call back and confess, and he vanished off the face of the earth. Now, wouldn't that already kind of argue against it being Rader?
No.
He could have done that from jail?
So the reason Rader's on the, in fact, that the reason Rader's on the hook for potentially for that one is he had some drawings of women and just of the faces, just of the like shoulder up.
Right.
That, and one of them looked very much like the mother, had short hair, which he didn't typically draw like that. That was an unusual drawing for him. But you can also argue, oh, he saw their picture in the newspaper. So right. So he did drawings of it, which he did often. So that doesn't make him a suspect just because he has drawings that look like victims.
Well, you're touching on something that I wanted to raise, which is that there have been some techniques used in the task force that have been very puzzling to me. Like, for example, using facial recognition software on drawings as if those drawings were real people. Chris, I mean, wouldn't you agree that's a strange method, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's how does AI know, you know, what the human face is going to look like? I mean, good grief.
But it's an assumption that those were real people that he was drawing and not just fantasy figures.
Yeah, that's part of the problem, right?
Right. But and Catherine, I was wondering if you could
I know the task force did make the announcement that one of the drawings was linked to a victim who had disappeared wearing green or, you know, whatever the color of the blouse right. was. And yet, why haven't we heard the results of that? I mean, that was months ago.
They used AI to do that?
That could be the one, yeah.
And because I didn't know if that was just something that one of the members of the task force just did on their own or if it was done officially as a...
It wasn't as if he had a lot of artistic talent. These are not highly detailed drawings.
Yeah, I mean, and plus, just always remember that artificial intelligence is machine learning. You have to teach the machine. So they could have just, you know, applied the drawing, and then the artificial intelligence, you know, took over and said, well, this is what it would have looked like.
Yeah.
When you know, you've seen that happen with the Savior. You know, with Jesus right. on the History Channel, you know, okay, is that what he really looks like? Really? I mean, we don't know. And
AI to try to estimate, you know, to make a...
Yeah, the artificial intelligence or even these, you know, you see it through, you know, children, right? That, you know, they do these enhancements for this is what they look like.
The age progression, yeah.
The age progression, right. And then you get the kid that is recovered, you know, 10 years later, and they don't look anything like the right. pictures. And so as a homicide investigator, we never, you know, relied on sketches. Number one, witness testimony is the worst testimony you could ever have. And then when you add a free sketch artist to that witness testimony, then they add their own, you know, interpretations of what the witness is saying until they finally get to, yeah, that kind of looks like him. And we had that in Leticia Hernandez, mm-hmm. you know, when she was kidnapped.
Case, Chris, that
And, you know, we had so many artistic renderings, you know, of what the two individuals look like who took her. And it ended up being a registered sex offender down the street. You know, it wasn't even related.
And so, and by the way, in that case, the judge really did a solid to the suspect. Right. I just to this day, after reading that whole situation, I couldn't believe it.
Yeah, you know, and we'll talk about that on another podcast for sure.
Or animal. Yeah, they used a lot of techniques that in this test force that are very puzzling. Like, for example, this thing of reading into things as if Rader was some kind of genius, where everything had a secret double meaning and were hidden codes. I mean, it's like a bad episode of CSI or something, where they're reading into things that likely have no significance at all. It starts to feel almost like a conspiracy theory, where you're connecting dots loosely.
Yeah.
And I just think they would really benefit from people, you know, who really have experience with this stuff, who would go in and say, that's kind of hokey. That's probably not anything.
Well, I mean, I don't want to get into details of exactly, right. But I was asked about a certain item that he had sent out of the prison and whether he had coded it. And I had to set them straight about what. And here's what really happened with that particular item. I don't know how you got from, you know, to your point that he's sending codes out to his followers to go find his trophies and dig them up. So he's definitely not doing that.
Right. It's a little loose. I mean, wouldn't you say, Chris, it's like trying to paint him as a kind of a mastermind, you know, criminal that's amusing himself with all these codes and messages, but it just doesn't jive with who he is. I mean, Catherine, isn't that even an exaggeration of his intellect?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it's the biggest mistake anybody can make. It's, you know, prescribing before you know what the diagnosis is. And that's tunnel vision. And that's why a lot of these cases don't get solved, because investigators, and we see it all day long, you know, when we do, you know, training and discussions like this, where, you know, they're just dead set. No, this is the way it is. This is the way it is. Well, you know what? I've worked over 300 murders in my career, and I've yet to find one that was exactly the way it was.
Yeah, I mean, I was troubled by a statement of, I'm 110% certain. Like,
there you go.
Oh, my. How does anybody make a statement? I'm not even. I know Dennis Rader probably better than anybody.
Yeah.
And I'm not certain of all the stuff about him.
I'm 110% sure that OJ is guilty.
Yeah. And he's paying that price right now. We'll see what happens there one day.
I saw in the Onion, you know, the satirical paper, did an article that said that because the coffin didn't fit, he has to be brought back to life. That's funny.
You know, so all over the country, or well, especially in the region, they're trying to link Dennis Rader to these killings, and is that kind of where we kind of cross over into your new book, Serial Killer's Apprentice, right? And can you give us a little outline about that? Because I was reading the Amazon description earlier before we got on, and I mean, it just sounds fascinating. I mean, he's paying this man who, you know, that they had that cold case from 99, and you'll go into that more, was recruiting children and paying them to.
Well, yeah, it was Dean Coral, who was an adult, 30 years old, who had used two teenage accomplices, David Brooks and Elmer Wayne Henley Jr., to procure other teenage boys to bring back to his house for parties. And whereupon he would pick one of them to bind and sexually assault and torture and then murder, and then they would be the cleanup crew. They'd have to be the ones to bury the bodies. But eventually he got Henley into also helping strangle and shoot some of the victims So Henley is the serial killer's apprentice. And I might add, he's the only accomplice to a serial killer who killed the killer to end it. And he did do that to his credit. And he has been in prison for 50 years. So that's similar to what we've been talking about. And he agreed to describe for me what it was like to be leveraged by this adult. He's 15 when he committed his first murder under the pressure, because Coral had said that there was this sex trafficking network that was that Coral was associated with. And if Henley didn't comply, that network was going to know it. And then he and maybe his family would suffer some consequences. So Coral knew it was a predator who knew how to leverage these vulnerable boys who needed money, who had from broken homes, from abusive homes. He twisted that, became their big brother, and then also offered to pay them. Henley says he only got paid once. I know that Brooks was getting paid more than that, but Brooks was in it for a longer period of time. He, in fact, brought Henley to Coral initially as a victim. So the only thing that saved him was at the last minute, they asked him, did you tell anyone where you were? And they were at Coral's house. And Henley said, I told my mother. So that's what saved him. I think he would have been killed that day.
I mean, I think it's important to emphasize that Coral, very different than Raider, in that he did engage in the most exquisite torture of people, children, torture board and the whole thing. And I mean, I know a great deal about the subject, but it's just too disturbing even here, you know, on this podcast where people are interested in the subject. I just think it would be outrageous even to repeat some of the things he did. What was the MO just so that the audience understands, in terms of, you know, what he was interested in doing and then how he eliminated bodies, and what's the gist of the...
Well, Coral sometimes acted on his own as well, by the way, and to the tune of at least 28 people, boys and young men, probably more, because I've worked out that there was a 9-year-old that nobody ever saw, and there was a victim in California that no one was able to identify. So he probably is in the 30s somewhere. And he would sometimes there were three main burial sites, but then they found a body on another beach that they hadn't known about. So there likely are unknown victims for Dean Coral. Essentially, he would, he was a very friendly kind of guy. Nobody really believed the story once the whole thing broke, that it could possibly have been him, because everybody thought he was a great guy. He was very effective at grooming the entire neighborhood into believing he was this big brother type, you know, who was giving boys a place to hang out, et cetera. Right. While in the meantime, he'd get them beer, he'd get them drugs, he'd get them acrylic paint to huff and get high. He'd do all kinds of things for them. He gave David Brooks a car, and that would be to soften them up, get them prepared. He was paying some of them for sexual contact, and then he would choose the ones that appealed to him, and sometimes he would keep them for several days bound, and often he would get two at once, put them both on the board, and have them, in one case he had them, they were best friends, you two fight each other, and the one who survives gets to leave. So imagine being, you know, you're terrified as it is, you're 16 or 17, and you have to now kill your best friend in order to leave. And of course, no one was going to ever leave. It was just a game to him. So he would torture them and finally, you know, have to kill them. And then he had Henley and Brooks take him to, he had a boat shed, the beach in High Island, and a place on a lake where he would bury the bodies.
And was it just specifically boys, males?
Yes, boys.
Underage.
Yeah, most of them, I think the youngest was 9, according to Brooks. And certainly there was an 11-year-old. There were 13 and 14, up to, I think, 18 or 19.
Yeah. Right. But mostly, yeah, towards the under 18.
Yeah. Wow.
Chris, in your years of investigating crimes against children, have you ever heard of someone who was doing it with a partner like that and engaging in torture and all of that? Because that's a rather unusual.
Bonin is another one.
Yeah, there are a few of them. Yeah, but quite rare. I mean, I'm just curious, Chris. I mean, you did that for a long time. It was your focus, crimes against children. Have you ever heard anything like that?
Not in San Diego, where I was at the time, you know, San Diego County. But, you know, of course, that was the only two perpetrators I remember back in the day was up in NorCal. Was it Ng, or if I remember?
Yeah.
Those two guys were kind of on our radar, you know, back in the day to see if anybody had, you know, crossed over into SoCal, but not with children. I mean, most of our, you know, David Westerfield and all those guys back in, you know, killing the kids.
You looked at Wesley Allen Dodd, though, didn't you? You spoke to Wesley Allen Dodd.
I interviewed Dodd. I was one of the last interviews just before they actually executed him. And the whole purpose for that was connecting back to the, you know, the Porter case, right? And remember, I went into homicide early 90, and Porter was just kind of wrapping up, i.e. they were just kind of, you know, getting this guy. But then we had all kinds of kids. We had like 6 or 7 children in San Diego County that had been murdered. And so I was selected to go to Walla Walla State Prison about a year or two after that to find out if, in fact, this guy, if it wasn't Porter, had the MO changed from Porter. If it was him, has his MO changed? And if it wasn't him, who could it be? So I had a chance to go up to Walla Walla. I spent almost 7.5 hours with Dodd getting into his head and trying to figure out what his victimology is. And quite frankly, you know, ask him, well, what do you think about this other stuff going on, you know, out there in San Diego, and give us some insight into that. And so that was my assignment. That was the mission that was given to me.
Yeah.
And you know, he was a real piece of work. I mean, you guys know, you know, Dr. and Dr. Bricado, you guys know.
Oh yeah.
That guy was pure evil.
Yeah.
I just watched that little piece somebody put together about him on YouTube.
Really?
Just, yeah, horrific. I mean, it's just,
well, Dodd had fantasies, like, you know, that involved, you know, castration of children and things like that. Really, really brutal. And the interesting thing about Dodd is that he said that if he were ever let go, he would do it again. That upon release, he would find a child and do it again. Had no remorse whatsoever. It's interesting, Catherine. Am I remembering correctly that I could be totally wrong on this, but that only one of the bodies found, the coral victims, like, is unidentified still? That they're trying.
Only one is unidentified, and I think they're getting close, and may have it, because I know that the anthropologist wants to write her own book, so maybe they already know. But there is just one left.
I think I remember that they think the kid might have some Hispanic origin. He would have been like a late teenager, that kind of thing. I mean, yeah. I'm going by my memory here, but I really do hope they get closure. I know that your co-author Tracy Ullman had also been very interested in the Gacy.
Yes.
Case, and did that wonderful series, you know, on John Wayne Gacy. I think there you've got that same situation, right? I mean, they're still trying to identify some people in the.
Yeah, there are certainly more with him than there are with Coral.
Right, but where I think you two have been so instrumental is reinventing what we know about these archetypical serial killers. That became the basis of everything we know about serial killers. I mean, you know, in this period, and it turns out that there's more of this engaging with other people, being part of a ring, etc., than we thought. Chris and I were just having a conversation with somebody, no need to say who it was, who was interested in understanding an offender that he's looking at. And he said to us, how common is it to work with someone else, you know? And Chris and I were saying to each other, well, most of these guys are going to operate alone, but there's new information that's making us think that a larger portion than we ever thought, due to this collaboration and this weird, these perverse alliances that they can form with other people. And it really starts to blow up the myth of the serial killer as always operating alone, like a master predator who can't form connections with people. And there are even ones that will do it with their romantic partners that, you know, thing too. And so I thought one of the most interesting things about this case is how much it teaches us about how even within, you know, in terms of being able to connect with a partner to kill, that you can form alliances, that there is that kind of fragmentation in your ability to relate to human beings. And I wonder, what did Henley think of Coral? Was he afraid of him? Did he admire him? Did he hate him? Was he?
He admired him and was afraid of him, but he did want to please him. And to this day, he doesn't understand why. Coral barely gave him anything, did anything for him. When he was over, he had to sleep on the floor. I mean, he said, they treated me like a dog. I don't know why I was in that position. And I think a lot of it had to do with his father, who had taken a gun to shoot him, to kill him twice, had beaten him, left the family. And he was at the age of 14 trying to help support his younger brothers. I think his vulnerability made him so easy to manipulate into this relationship.
I can tell you from personal experience that, you know, as somebody, my Dr. Ramsland, I don't know if you know this, probably not, but my father killed my mother when I was a little boy, and my sister and I, we were there and other family members. And there becomes this kind of vacuum for attention and want and acceptance. And fortunately for me, I was adopted by my grandparents, who were a good influence on my life, but it could have gone the complete opposite way. And, you know, these predators, not only are they out there to do harm for their own satisfaction, but they'll pull you in any chance that they get, you know. And I mean, I've, you know, from being involved in victim witness to talking to other families of domestic violence and murder, a lot of kids end up going the opposite way solely because they are just looking for somebody to attach to. And a lot of kids end up in these, you know, the foster homes and things like that. So, but then at the same time, and Dr. Gary, you would, I'm sure you've heard this kind of stuff before too. For a very, very long time, I still wanted my father, who was in prison, who I never had any really contact with, to be proud of me somehow. And I would always go, why do I even care? I don't know why I care. The closest answer I ever got was just this biological need for your parent, you know, to please your parents.
And that's how Wayne said. In fact, when he killed Coral, the first thing that he thought was he'd be so proud that I followed his directions and how to do this.
Right. It's really, it's a real struggle with the soul when you have to deal with that kind of stuff. And so I can understand, you know, from where he's going, I don't know why I needed to please him, but I just felt the need to. And I can understand from a smaller scale, but it really does mess with your head, especially right around the time of puberty and teenage years. I mean, kids are so that easily manipulated, you know, especially ones that don't have a solid family backing, you know, like I did. Like I said, I went from a very bad situation to a really good situation. I was one of the lucky ones. It doesn't happen very often. So,
Josh, there's a thing, you know, this concept of Stockholm syndrome, where a person starts to love or care about their captor or the person who's being cruel to them. And there's this whole hypothesis that it's evolutionary, that you have to get along with the person because your survival depends on them. So you find a way to love them or care about them. And we see that in children that are abused from a young age, that because there has to be an attachment on this person upon whom you depend, you have to sort of like encode. Some people think at a dopamine level, you have to encode that that is good, that that person cares about you. And for the rest of your life, you'll go out having relationships with awful people because you think that that's love. That's a real phenomenon. And the other thing you're touching on that I think is a brilliant point is that there are some people who are these kind of secondary psychopaths. Because they come from a horrendous background, they'll engage in awful things because they get pulled into it, like what happens with kids in gangs and things like that. Sure. They can get sucked in, and they are not really psychopathic. I do not believe that Henley is a psychopath.
No, I have the theory of the temporary psychopath. Under the influence, right. He was able to act. Once he's out from the influence, he wanted to be a minister.
Right.
So he's horrified at what he did. He's so glad to have this book because we use it to help warn people about these predators and what to do. There's an entire chapter devoted just to parents, counselors, and teachers.
Chapter eight.
Here's what to look for.
Chapter eight.
Closer than they appear. That's the chapter name. And it is riveting.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's one of those things where you at a certain point in your life, you are responsible for the things that you do and your actions. But when things are kind of imprinted in your mind at a young age, it's hard to shake that kind of stuff. Once you've kind of, for lack of a better term, broke bad, you know, and you have done these awful things, it's like, well, I'm kind of at the point of no return. And it seems like, you know, that's just from the little bit that I know about him, that's kind of, you know, he was very much manipulated and groomed, if you will.
Yeah.
And then, but you know, at that age, you know right from wrong still, too. That's that. So it's weird because you do feel bad that he was ever introduced to this monster and then it turned into a monster of his own. You know, I mean, it's
right.
You feel
it's hard
bad
to know how to react.
Yes. It's very difficult to understand. Very difficult.
I understand that he heard the program we did with Tracy and you and Chris. And I think who else was there? Chris, was Catherine, me, you and Tracy.
Yep. Yep. That was just the four of us.
But
what was his feedback? Yeah.
And he listened to it. A friend of his had the phone and he listened to it.
That's
he
cool.
Said it was the first time he realized, despite us working together for 2 years and me assuring him I wasn't going to screw him over like many media people have. It was the first time he realized you are actually true to your word and you delivered the message.
Good for you.
Yeah.
That's so important. And I think that's why personally, this is a must read for every law enforcement officer out there, especially if you're doing homicide. It's The Serial Killer's Apprentice, the true story of how Houston's deadliest murderer turned a kid into a killing machine. And the author is obviously Dr. Catherine Ramsland and Tracy Ullman, the co-author. So this is a great book. You need to pick it up. And for parents, you know, chapter eight, again, Closer Than They Appear, lays out how to avoid, at least give you some insight in avoiding the type of personality that would create these horrendous types of crimes and hopefully maybe save your child or somebody else's as a whole. Now, I love the book. I really do. I think it's a real keeper.
Thank you.
Do you have any jitters the night before? Or you've done this so many times.
I'm in the 70s now. So, but it's still exciting. It never gets old. I mean, and this particular book is very meaningful to me.
So. What's that, Chris?
I say her book on BTK is a home run as well. I mean, we talked about Dennis Rader tonight and then of course we got Dr. Bricado over here with the new evil. I mean, it just gets better every moment, every single moment.
Well, you know, my co-author loved Catherine. And he used to call her the doyen of true crime. crazy about Catherine Hanson, and understandably. I've always been very grateful because when I did New Evil, that's how I got to meet a lot of people, including Catherine. That's how we first got together, and we've developed a really nice friendship. And so I've been really grateful for that. And of course, we lost Michael in December, which was very hard. You know, Catherine's written about so many things. You know, I think sometimes people pigeonhole her, you know, is writing about BTK or something, but she contributed to such a wide array of subjects that it would be really difficult to really, I mean, even subjects like, you know, being interested in like the preternatural and the supernatural and, you know, and the, those phenomenon, how people are interested in them, all the way to, you know, wider, like things like physicians who kill and couples who kill and, you know, and all kinds of contributions to the spree killer literature. I mean, it's just so much stuff. And of course, has the wonderful program at DeSales. And I love that you have that what is that, like a murder house or like homicide? Or what is that?
Crime scene house.
Tell people about that, because it's like we probably have some people in the audience who are really interested in pursuing careers in forensics.
I'm about to retire, and I think the crime scene house is going to be closed down. Unfortunately,
Bring it to Crime Con.
Well, I am going to bring it. I'm going to bring some of the crime scenes I laid out to KillerCon in Green Bay in June. So.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't even know about
that. That's the Writers Police Academy. That's where writers go to learn from police at a police academy, all different kinds of, you know, authentic skills and whatnot.
It's fascinating that the fate. Oh, go ahead, Chris, please.
No, that's fine.
I was going to say, it's fascinating how fate ties people together. Do you realize, Chris, that when that terrible thing happened at the university where your son was affected, Catherine had been there teaching. Literally, I mean, it's like leaves town, a mass shooting happens. Yep. Your son is like the hero of the hour. It's like bizarre how threads of fate come together, right? Catherine, weren't you right there?
I was right. I was in the cab right next to it when it was happening. Yeah.
That was the Polito case, right? The Polito mass shooting.
Yeah.
Yep. The universe is on schedule. You know, the last guy that got shot, he's still alive. He got shot 10 times.
Wow.
And he was at my son's door. Because my son's the chair of the economics department. And he was running down the hallway, and the suspect shot him 10 separate times, you know, 10 times. And all of that blood and everything, when the cops got up to the fifth floor where Ian's office is, and they opened, you know, when they told him to come out, the SWAT team got him out. All of that, there was blood trails going all the way down, and the victim managed to make it to the stairwell and get down. And as he came out, he collapsed, and the suspect had chased him down there, and that's when they engaged him. He just walked right past all the kids and everything. And now here's another twist of fate. The officer, one of the officers involved in that, is a guy named Damian Garcia. And he was a Carlsbad police officer in Southern California. And my oldest son, Ian, used to play hockey with him when my son was in high school. Damian would play with all the kids and they'd do roller hockey and stuff. And so the guy that ends up shooting the guy is my son, knows him since he was in high school. It was crazy. And in fact, Damian sent me a note about 2 weeks ago, you know, wanting to talk to Ian, and I ended up, you know, giving him his inside number.
Well, Chris, I know you're interested, and I think it's absolutely fascinating, but I know you're interested in these cases where it almost feels that a spiritual thing happens that protects people in law enforcement or whatever, where you have these stories that you can't explain. I know we've talked about how you gather those stories. You're interested in that subject. I think it's like a fascinating subject.
Yeah, I called it the thin blue veil.
Huh.
You know, right? And I'm going to coin that, by the way, for the record, everybody, thin blue veil.
What does that mean?
Well, I've always believed that there's a supernatural and or a spiritual dynamic to the type of work we're all engaged in here. I can't put my finger on it. I mean, I personally have my own religious beliefs, but I do believe that the other side can assist us. And I can tell you story after story, you know, in just my own experiences, but I've always been fascinated in, you know, listening to doctors, you know, medical personnel, and maybe we can do, you know, a segment on those types of things and get folks in here that have had those types of experiences.
We should do a book, Chris. I think that if you've collected those over the years, I mean, there are stories like that. I mean, I remember hearing, for example, that one of the women who survived the Chi Omega house where Bundy broke in told her priest, who then shared the story with a biographer of Bundy, that when he came into the room to kill her with the log, you know, with the log, she happened to be praying the rosary. And he looked down, saw the rosary, closed the door, and left. Survived.
Yeah.
And felt that supernaturally she had been protected by that. And there are many, many stories like that. And another example is Richard Ramirez, the Night Stalker, told the story that he had broken into a house and was strangling, a 16-year-old with phone cord. And she started to pray, if I remember correctly. And an electrical jolt came out of the wire, stung him, and he believed it was God. So he left, and she survived. And he had gotten zapped by in the middle of the praying. I mean, there are stories like that that really are fascinating. And there are even cases, which, I mean, people are gonna out there are going to have a laugh that we're even talking about. But there are even cases where cases have been solved by people who have had these peculiar supernatural experiences, strange dreams.
It's a gift.
Visions, things where, I mean, I am familiar with a case in my records here, bizarre. A person who had a very distinct vision of something pointing to a wall in which evidence was contained that then led to the solving of a homicide. Catherine, I'm sure you're familiar with cases like that in your...
I know one where the ghost got into court.
How cool is that? How cool is that?
That's how they solved it, so they had to testify about that.
Oh, I'd love to hear about that. And then there are cases like, remember the demon murder case where the person became the first person in American history whose defense was that he was demonically influenced. It was one of those very controversial cases that had to do with the Warrens, if I remember correctly. They had looked at that case. There are just some really weird stories.
Dennis Rader said he was demon possessed initially.
Yeah, that wouldn't surprise me a bit.
I mean, that's got to be possible, right? I mean,
here's a perspective. It's an interesting question. I mean, obviously, if you're not religious, it becomes...
Okay, I'm going to tell you a story, just 30 seconds.
Let's hear it.
I had Brandon Wilson, right, who killed Matthew Checkey. He slaughtered him in a bathroom. And while I'm interviewing him, the whole room went ice cold. And it stopped. He stopped and looked at me and he says, "You know who I am, don't you?" Mm-hmm. And I was like, the hairs on my arm, my neck, my back, everything. I was like, and I leaned over and I said, "Yes, I do. Let's take a break." And I walked out and the guy that was with me, Tom Morgans, goes, "Dude, did you feel that?" I said, "Feel that? Did you see that?" I said, "That guy is possessed. He's evil." And I'll tell you, to this day, I remember the moment. Okay. And then later on, the funny part of this story is I had my pen in my front shirt pocket. And when it was all over, after we'd done the interview and he had demonstrated how he killed the kid on me and stuff, I still have my pen in there. And Tom goes, "Hey, stupid, you had your pen the whole time. He could have stuck you in the neck with it." And I'm like, "Holy cow, you're right. I'm so sorry. Where was my wingman?" You know, when I'm there with the devil and you're sitting there taking notes, telling me I got my pen, and we laugh for a little bit to break the tension. But, oh, I totally believe in just my personal belief system. But, yeah, it's bad.
Dr. Ramblin, you've sat with people that would be considered evil. I mean, have you ever felt anything? I would say, I'm not saying supernatural, but have you ever felt anything quite like what Chris is kind of talking about there?
Yeah, because I mean, I've pursued the ghost subculture and the undercover with vampires, and so I've definitely come across people like that. I did a lot of what I call immersion journalism, where I mingled with these people.
Yeah, because I always tell this all the time to my audience, is that I like the supernatural. I don't really deal with it, because it actually frightens me. Like when you brought up Ed and Lorraine Warren, you know, and I used to.
I knew them, and you did too, Catherine, right?
Yes.
I mean, same characters.
No question about it. But I mean, there seemed to have been some substance of what they were talking about too. I mean, they were all the way into it. And I'm not saying that them specifically, but just in general, I mean, there are things that can't be explained by humans that happen all the time. And I mean, and if you believe in souls, if you believe, if you listen, you know, read the Bible, they talk about casting demons out of people into pigs, and then they jump off the, you know, the side of a hill into the water. Legion. Yeah. And so, yeah, I've always, you know, I've had people say, psychics and things ask me, would you like to do a reading, you know, for your mother and things like that? And I just go, you know, it's just not something that I'm not saying that I believe it. I'm not saying I don't believe it. I'm just not interested in it, if that makes any sense. And some,
well, you know, I'll tell you this, I had a medium in, I think it was 2009, urged me to, she said she was hearing something like Candyland or Candyman, and I needed, and it was involved three, and I needed to contact one of them. That was how long ago, and here I am with Henley with the Candyman.
Right.
What do you say about that stuff, right? Yeah. I mean, but I can also tell you, I've had some problems too. I've got a coffee cup back here. It says McRockpile on it because I was assigned all the psychics when go on. And I can tell you, man, oh man, have I dug up things and go, are you sure? And they're like,
that's
yeah,
how you solved, right. That's how you solved your cases, because you dug stuff up like that, even though you didn't want to.
I got a coffee cup that says McRockpile.
You got to do it.
I have a book called Paranormal Forensics. And
interesting.
I talk about psychics who were dead wrong and misled police all over the place. And yet here and there, they were not wrong. Well,
beautiful segue here, because I do really believe that there are people out there that have gifts. And there are people out there that fake those gifts, and they give people that have the actual gift just a bad name. It's the same thing as, like, you know, big, you know, people that are truly hunting for Bigfoot, right? I mean, you know, we all don't, you know, if you believe in Bigfoot, then, but there are so many phonies, there's so many fake stories about it. And then you hear something credible and you're going, yeah, I don't know about that though, right. You know? And so that's another thing, a reason that I kind of stay away from it, because I do on some level go, I don't know. I mean, that person might have it, and I don't know if I want any part of it, you know? I completely get what you're saying. There are people that seem to have gifts, but they're few and far between. It's not like everybody, like on YouTube or TikTok, there are so many psychics, you know, and they couldn't find, you know, water if they fell out of a boat. Like, it's just, it's ridiculous, you know?
Well, a lot of people don't realize that I had gone to school for years to become a priest, to become a Catholic priest before I became a shrink. And I'll tell you that, you know, one of the things I found fascinating that I learned is that every diocese in the Catholic Church has an exorcist. And they go in with a mental health professional to look at these cases. 99% of the time, they're explained by, you know, people that are faking things or people that have psychiatric phenomena. But then every once in a while, there's an oddball case that you just can't explain. The church deals with it quietly. It doesn't make its way into the paper. And it is the weirdest stuff you've ever heard of. I mean, things that are just completely impossible scientifically. And the church kind of deals with it and tucks it away. And that's the end of it. But it happens. And, you know, and I've learned to take a very humble attitude about it. You know, the what's that line from Shakespeare? There's more to heaven and earth that are dreamed of in your philosophy. Well, I think there's a little truth to that. And so but
there's a lot of truth to that.
Yeah, where it crosses over into forensics, it gets very fascinating. I mean, you'll get we happen to be four people that are open to discussing this, but I think a lot of people would have a good chuckle that we're even talking about this. But there are stories that are just so bizarre. I mean, I was just reading before I got on here about a woman who was a survivor of the Lusitania. Do you remember the famous boat that was bombed by a U-boat in World War One? And she said that she was on the deck and she looked up and she saw an exact copy of herself, a doppelganger of herself, became so weirded out by this that she ran up to the top deck to investigate, and the bomb didn't hit her. She survived because of seeing her doppelganger. And I learned that that story was the basis of Stephen King writing a book called The Outsider about a murder where there's DNA of a killer who was not there. And he cannot explain how his DNA is on the body because Stephen King became fascinated by that story, which has never been explained. And there are loads of those. I mean, you know, there are fascinating people like Charles Fort that spent their entire lives collecting these in big volumes of these things that you just can't explain. But Chris, one day we've got to get that pile of stories you have out and do something with it, because who knows what it'll stir up. Yeah.
Dr. Ramsland, I'm going to leave you with this. And you're probably going to go, okay, this guy's out of his mind. I got a new puppy a couple of years ago. His name's Otis. It's the cutest thing you've ever met. He's a little French bulldog. And at one point, I was convinced that he was possessed by a demon because he chewed my grandmother's Bible up that was given to her by the pastor at her husband's funeral, my grandfather. And then he made a circle out of his toys one day while I'm watching him pee's right in the middle of it. It looked like a pentagram, right? And I looked at him and I said, he's eating a Bible and he's doing sacrifices in the house. And somebody had me convinced that I was going to buy some holy water on Amazon from the River Jordan and perform an exorcism on him. And after I threatened him with it, I think the spirits left him because he's a good boy now, but it took a little while. So I'm going to have to check out your book, because I mean, I do think that maybe in a fleeting moment that he may have had a touch of the possession. You know, he's just, when he ate my grandma's Bible, I mean, he chewed a hole right through it. And I went, oh no, she was getting ready to go to church. She set it on her cart and he grabbed it off, ran outside with it, chewed a hole right in it.
Oh my goodness.
Brought it in. And I just told
her. Was it leather bound?
Oh yeah. Yeah. There you go. It was all engraved. And it was one of the saddest things. I felt so bad.
If he starts talking, I'm going to hang up on you.
It's hilarious. No, but I think just one day we've got to also talk about all the charlatans in this business. And I will tell you, Catherine, I always felt a little uncomfortable about the Warrens. But
I can tell you a lot, but not on a recording.
Yeah, we'll talk in private. But you remember Sylvia Brown?
Yes.
You remember the woman who claimed to be a psychic, and she told a family that their child was dead.
And I can tell you about her and the publishing world.
Oh, she's.
I remember her. She used to be on Montel all the time.
Long nails, those creepy looking nails. She made a fortune making up absolute gibberish to people. There was this wonderful guy. I used to get such a kick out of him, called James Randi. He was a magician who was a master illusionist. You know, he figured out every trick in the book of how to fool people, and as a consequence, became interested in how people making spiritual claims can fool people. And he became the master of exposing total BS artists who would use everything from fake seances to phony psychics. One time he did this fascinating experiment. You could watch it on YouTube, where he went to Russia to go see these two sisters that were supposed to be the greatest psychics that helped the police, etc. And they were psychometrists. So you would give them an object, they would touch it and read it and whatever. And he gave them a photograph, and they gave this whole reading at great length with dozens of points about this personality, this person, what a good person he was, and so forth. It turned out it was a photo of Ted Bundy. He had given them made total mockeries of the two of them. But he used to do this thing where he would carry around $1 million check. And he said that he would give it to the first person who could actually prove one of these phenomena. And he never found one. So, I mean, I think that's the whole thing, is that there's that because of the nebulousness of this stuff, it also opened up this whole new avenue of crime, where you've got phonies that take advantage of people. But then embedded within that, there are, as you were saying, Josh, there are these fascinating cases where you do have to kind of wonder. And people, and I will emphasize that when I was in seminary, what used to fascinate me is people forget that even in Christianity, one of the predominant religions of this world, right? People forget that ultimately, after the resurrection, Christ did a lot of the things that ghosts do. Walk through walls, was able to levitate and ascend into heaven, was able to look different than he was and fool people that he was somebody else, you remember, on the road to Emmaus, etc. And, you know, and so that you have to ask yourself, is that a coincidence? I mean, we believed that there was in Christianity, that there was a resurrection, and he was able to do things like that. He, remember when the apostles are in the room, he walked right in through the wall into the room where they were. So that I just don't think it's so weird for people who are Christian to believe things like that.
I agree.
Right. And I will also tell you that having been in seminary, I encountered, particularly in hospitals, people who had the most extraordinary spiritual experiences, particularly before passing. They would tell you things that you would never forget as long as you live. I mean, unbelievable things, visitations. I'm at peace now because this person came and told me this and turned out to be true. Family confirmed it, you know, like a secret that no one, that they didn't know, you know, stuff like that. So I walked away from it realizing that you have to keep an open mind, because there is stuff that happens you're just never going to be able to explain. And it opens up this whole beautiful other way of thinking about life, where you never be afraid of death, you know? So, but don't you think, Chris?
Yeah, I can tell you, sitting in those rooms after the victim's been taken out and just contemplating, you know, 15, 20 minutes staring at each wall, you know, and just, they will, you know, people would look, because I'd go back in, you know, after everything was buttoned up, and I'd put a chair in the middle, you know, or at least close to the middle of the room, and everybody would be like, you know, where's McDonough? Oh, he's in there. Okay. But I learned so much just by listening and feeling and thinking, you know, about that victim and about that crime, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, but then I had really one really weird experience where it was an officer involved shooting, and she had come out of a bathroom at the officers with a butcher knife, and they were kind of compressed in a hallway. And as she was coming out, the boom, the officer had a, you know, shooter. Anyway, she was there, and, you know, I had to go in, and I'll never forget, she had fallen down, and her eyes were wide open, and you could see the, you know, whatever it was, still locked into her. And I'll never forget the evidence tech. She goes, her name was Cheryl. He goes, step over her. I go, oh, you first. I'll wait over here. See this, detective? See that camera? Okay, you step over. Okay. Yeah. And but I don't think people understand how that kind of breaks up, you know, even though it's kind of a sick humor, but it's a healthy humor. And, but when we looked down, when she looked down stepping over, she goes, oh my God, No way. And I'm like, I'm not coming. I'll wait right here. Tell me what's on the other side over there. Anyway, eventually I had to do it, but it was so weird. So to your point, you know, I don't know what happens sometimes. I do believe there's something definitely on the other side over there. I believe that personally.
I agree with that as well.
Well, it certainly lends a lot of hope to people that deal with the kinds of things we do. I'll tell you that much. And I think, Chris, that's why it always feels that there's such a spirituality to the interview room and the lab, the shows you do, where I think, you know, as I always say, there's almost like a ministry-like quality because you're really helping a lot of people that are suffering. And one of the things I hope happens here in this debut episode of this podcast is that people start to realize that it's very victim-focused, that our job is not to be sensational and enjoy talking about the offenders except as a means to prevention. That's why I loved Chapter 8 in Catherine's book, because I think it really gets right to the point that we're only interested in these people, these non-entities, because we want to prevent more of this. We're not dedicating our lives to this because it's amusing. And I think we do see ourselves as in a almost cosmic battle against a kind of darkness. There's too much of it. But it's not easy. And another great topic to talk about one day is how we keep it balanced, how it doesn't gobble us up. I think the number one question, Catherine, don't you get that question when you do
talk? All the time.
How do you keep from losing your mind? You know, how do you balance it? And I think it, what I would say in summation is that I think, as Michael and I used to talk about this, is that because we're both people that if you knew us in private life, you'd say we were actually very light people. And the reality is, I think that you become more keenly aware of goodness when you spend all day paying attention to this dark stuff. You know, so
we got that question at CrimeCon last year.
I'm still looking for the recording of that interview, by the way. I don't know of anybody who taped it, but I want to watch it. I'm curious. But so anyway, maybe that's a good note to close.
Yeah. Yeah. And Dr. Ramsland, I we're all very grateful for your time. Yeah. And I'm really excited about your book. I'm looking forward to reading it. And I don't know if I'll be able to read all 71 because I'm just, you know, I struggle.
When's a philosophy book? You can forget that one.
Okay. That's good. I've read up on philosophy for a while. I think I'm good. But so we have the Serial Killer's Apprentice, and the release date's actually April 16th, which is tomorrow. So it'll be probably the 17th by the time this is out. So it'll be ready for you guys to go. Pick it up. And also the New Evil with Dr. Gary Bricado. Also, that book is huge.
Yes, it is.
It is a big,
a great reference.
Didn't mess around with
it. A lot of the information in it, man. Yeah. And how long did that take you to write?
Oh, it was a couple of years. But I'll tell you that what I've been most proud of with that book is that they use it in a few courses around the country. People really got interested in the more, I don't know how else to put it, a more granular, maybe more sophisticated way of thinking about people, instead of saying like all people who commit serial killing are the same, all people who murder are the same. And I think, like, for example, there is a very clear distinction between Henley on that scale that we talk about, right, as somebody who is gets pulled into committing offenses, but he is not a psychopath, to someone like Coral, who is all the way at the top of the scale at 22, right? We're engaging in exquisite torture with sexual motives. And I think it really does enrich the way you think about cases. It's hard stuff, very gruesome, because the facts speak for themselves and it's dark, you know. And I think the other thing that book did, that at first, you know, people, you know, it took them a little while to get into it, and now I see people talking about it, is this notion that there are cultural factors that are changing the nature of crime over the past decades, so that what was once the crime of the century is now, you know, page 20 in the paper because it's so common. And that's another thing that a lot of religious groups have contacted me that they're fascinated by, because they see it from that angle. I see it from an angle of cultural change, technological change, so forth, that have contributed to a breakdown in the personality structure of the average individual. and increase the audacity and the narcissism of the average person. But it's a really interesting read. And I'm proud to say it's been, at several points it was the number one bestseller on Amazon and in forensic psychology. And I know Catherine's book is going to shoot up there very quickly. You will all have it on your shelves. And I really want to thank you, Catherine, because it's a big honor to have you here for the inaugural.
Yeah, I appreciate being asked. I'm very honored myself to be here.
Yeah. Well, to christen the ship, so to speak.
We're very grateful.
Yes.
Thank you. Well, there it is. The very first of hopefully a lot of episodes of The Witness Box. Very cool. Thank you guys very much. And we'll talk soon.